What am I looking at?
Those ships are Klingon.
You are gifted. You are brave. Find a way to help those who need you.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge...
This is Tyler Orton watching his DNA unravel like noodles.
Yes, and now for this week's conundrum, we're going to talk about the first two episodes of Star Trek Discovery.
This is the Vulcan Hello and yes. Battle at... The Binary Stars. Can we just watch this on the Space Channel here in Canada? We watch it live to air. It's a very exciting thing. A lot of people, they're doing it on it, say, half, you know, CBS All Access, half CBS.
They seem very confused online from what I'm reading.
Yeah, and then the rest of the world experiencing it on Netflix, so we're going to jump into it. Kim, we also want to do something a little different. I think, you know, you're going to hear a lot of recaps about episode by episode for this series. We want to kind of bring it back to our own podcast where we've covered what we're at episode like 170 something at this point.
Something like that, yeah.
So we've got so many topics to go through. Why don't we kind of recontextualize some of the topics that we've done in the past? And I think the one that makes the most sense, if we're tackling a show that's being led by one Sneakwa Martin Green as Lieutenant Commander, or no, just Commander, Michael Burnham, why don't we contextualize this as Ranking the First Officers? That's
right.
A great episode that we did just a few months back, talking all about the Riker versus Spock versus Kira, et cetera, et cetera. Chakotay ranked very, very high on your list.
Of course, yes. Right near the top, spoiler. Yeah. But, and if you know, you're a new listener to this episode, you can go to the blog post at subspacepod.com, and I'll have a link to that episode if you want to catch up on that.
Yeah. So why don't we just jump into it and begin with our discussion? We're going to hop back and forth between Binary Star.
We're just so excited. We can't even focus.
Yeah. We'll be hopping back and forth between episodes one and two. But I think we want to start contextualizing things with regards to episode one.
Right.
So why don't we hop into it? The Vulcan Hello, we are introduced to one Michael Burnham as our first officer aboard the USS Shenzhou. Mm-hmm. We were calling it the Shenzhou for a long time, but I guess it's actually pronounced the Shenzhou.
No one ever corrected me, so I just went with it.
Okay. So we're introduced to her. I think this is a very interesting case because I think Sneakwa Martin Green, she's well known within the Walking Dead community.
Right.
I was familiar with her.
I was not at all.
Yeah. Tell me about it as just from the actor standpoint. SMG, what do you get from her watching the Vulcan Hello?
I really had not a lot of concerns about her just going off of the marketing. I thought, no, this actress definitely has, you know, the right delivery, the right gravity to her, to the way she's carrying herself on the show that, you know, while other people were kind of concerned, like, oh, is she going to be able to lead the show? I really had no concerns. And watching the Vulcan Hello, again, I was like, no, I think they found the actress to lead this show.
Like, she's somebody who can carry an entire series, essentially.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those, you know, I just think strong casting choices where it's someone who's a little unknown, at least to a lot of the audience. Kind of like, you know, I think of like Daisy Ridley with The Force Awakens, where it's like, you know, to a lot of people, they're like, who is this actress? But within seconds, you're like, I'm along for the ride. She's got it.
Cam, I remember you and I, we walked out of The Force Awakens, and I was just like, I don't know who this Rey character is, but I am sucked in. It totally grips me. I feel very much the same way about SMG. I've seen all of her episodes in The Walking Dead. The Walking Dead is a series that I have very mixed feelings on. It's one of the few that I'll say it, don't hate me, but I kind of still hate watch it.
Right.
I've sunk cost theory. I've seen so many episodes. I just continue to follow it. And I always thought that Sasha, her character, was an okay character, but is a good actress behind it. I like what SMG is bringing into this sort of role here. Why don't we jump into her central conflict, though, Cam? She is somebody, human, raised by Vulcans, Sarek, and Amanda Grayson as well. And her family was killed off by the Klingons, so she already has kind of that... conflict with the Klingons, as well as her internal conflict going on. Do you think this is a good way to start off with your lead character, giving them something that they're, I guess, invested in? Is that the right word?
Well, I mean, given that this you know, whole season seems to be about the Klingon War, it immediately gives a personal cost to your protagonist. So, I mean, it's a pretty good shorthand for a lead character.
Okay.
Some could call it maybe a little too convenient, but let's see how it plays out. You know, going right off the bat of episode one, you understand why this matters to her. So, hey, it works.
Okay. She jumps onto the Klingon sarcophagus ship. And she encounters the torchbearer, which she had a very funny line, something along the lines of like, yeah, the torchbearer somehow fell into his own weapon.
Even I was confused by that scene as to what was happening.
Yeah.
So,
you know. And she admitted, I killed him. But the way that she phrased it, I got a bit of a chuckle out of it. It's
right.
Just like, it was his own fault. Is this torchbearer kind of the lamest fighter among the Klingon Empire at this point?
Kind of like trips over himself and kills himself. You know, we saw the Torchbearer uniform in Star Trek Las Vegas Con. And I got to say, it looked a lot more impressive, you know, seeing it in the flesh or the armor or whatever you want to call it, as opposed to seeing it on screen.
Yeah, this felt more like a Jacques Cousteau sort of incident here.
You know? It's like, did you ever see For Your Eyes Only where Bond battles in Undersea, the guy in the deep sea suit? Where it's kind of clunky and you can tell it's awkward for the actor. That's kind of how this felt. Like I'm watching someone in this giant suit of armor kind of just fall on a blade.
Sorry, I apologize. I said Jacques Clouseau. I meant Inspector Clouseau from Pink Panther.
People mix up those two all the time.
I just feel very, very dumb. But honestly, like this torchbearer, he ain't much. No wonder that his brother was so reluctant to take up the cause. Orek, I believe the Klingon's name is. Which kind of brings me into this. What do you make of Vok, son of Nun?
I think he's an interesting character.
I was actually really sucked into this guy.
We've never really seen a Klingon character like this. Someone who's just completely disgraced and coming from nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And being brought into sort of the Klingon ranks of power, at least within this, you know, this group here that's, you know, trying to bring the 24 houses together. I like this character, and I'm interested to see where they go.
He's clearly meant to be kind of an albino character. I don't know. I'm sure that's kind of in proper terminology nowadays. But do you recall the albino in Blood Oath, the Star Trek Deep Space Nine episode? That's where my mind kept going.
That's, what, season three, I think?
I think it was season three. It was pre-Worf. It was Jadzia. She was hanging out with Kor, Koloth, and
Kang.
I'm blanking on that. So it was kind of a cool shout-out. The connection, though, is that Kol, the one Klingon from the High Houses that refused to engage in this battle at the Binary Stars, he's actually a House of Kor. That was revealed to us at the convention that we were at back in Star Trek Las Vegas camp.
Yeah. And Kor, of course, is from the episode Errand of Mercy from the original series. Kol is a character who we saw very little of him in this episode, but he's someone I feel like we're going to see a lot more from. So I was really kind of hanging on to that character to see what was going to come, but you know, it was kind of more of a tease than anything.
And just refresh my memory, I believe he initially appeared in Battle of the Binary Stars.
He did, yes.
Okay. So it's kind of, maybe this is kind of a central issue that we're going to have, is that these episodes are clearly, it's a new era of Star Trek, very serialized here.
Yeah, heavily so.
So it might be a little tough. When we're watching them back to back, I might get some things mixed up. What do you make of this kind of keeping the episodes apart? Was that a bit of a challenge at points?
Well, I will say I think it's going to be far easier going forward when we're just doing one
week
episode per
week.
Yes,
okay.
I don't think we'll stumble as much in terms of kind of confusing the two. In this case, yeah, you know, watching it, I began to wonder why they didn't just release it as a 2-hour pilot because, you know, Star Trek traditionally has always done that with the exception of the original series. So, you know, you had a fairly complete 2-hour premiere here.
Yeah.
And so to split it up, I don't know how I feel about it because to me, they feel, it is one story. This was not, you know, two sort of episodes that maybe have an arc but have different stories going on. It was one story.
Yeah. The other thing that was confusing because I think this could have been maybe a 3-episode premiere because you and I got to the very end of Battle.
Yeah.
And we fast forward on my PVR because the show started a little late and you and I were chatting a little bit. Fast forwarded on the PVR and then we realized, this is the end of the episode. And we thought that there'd be another act explaining, spoiler alert, that one Michael Burnham has been imprisoned for life. That's her sentence for her actions aboard the Shenzhou.
End of series.
Yeah. Yes. So, Kim, this is not the first time the Klingons have been introduced or reintroduced to us. We have Errand of Mercy, the motion picture, Heart of Glory, a Broken Bow.
Even Search for Spock sort of reintroduces the Klingons in a lot of ways, too. The motion picture doesn't really show much of them.
Sure.
Whereas we're seeing more of a development of the Klingon culture in Star Trek III.
So out of all these introductions slash reintroductions that we've witnessed throughout, 50 years of Star Trek, where would you place this?
I don't know that I can rank it, but I can say that I enjoyed it.
Does it work for you?
It did work for me. Okay. I have some issues with sort of, and this is going to come into the larger picture stuff, where it felt like the dialogue was very expositional.
Okay.
In a way where I was like, I never felt like I was learning anything about any of these Klingon characters. I was more learning what is going on with Klingon society.
But some of the stuff that we see with Vok, though, I feel as if like
there's bits there.
Okay.
There's bits.
Okay, but what about all the expositional stuff with T'Kuvma, where we find out where his ship comes from? There's I guess a lot of kids playing hacky sack aboard his father's derelict vessel, and so he gets beaten up by these hippies.
Right.
And I do feel like I get a bit of a taste for some of the I guess the motivation behind some of these characters, at least.
Like, to me, it presented the Klingons in a way, and I griped, you know, quite a bit when we were, you know, seeing the early teases of what Discovery was about. I said, you know, if you want to get me excited about Star Trek, don't show me Klingons.
Yeah.
It's like I've seen it a billion times. What I appreciate was watching, you know, this two-parter, but, you know, Vulcan Hello to focus on first. It didn't feel like I'd seen this before. The idea of sort of seeing this, you know, this Klingon trying to start basically a holy war is something that I never felt like I'd seen it tackled in this sort of way. This feels very of the now in the way they're dealing with the Klingons.
Very similar to maybe what we're seeing in Star Trek Enterprise when it premiered back in 2002. And, you know, there's a lot, like, you have the Suliban. That was right when pop culture is being familiarized with the Taliban.
Right. And right now, you know, there's a lot of terrorist attacks and Al-Qaeda and things like that. And so there's a lot, you know, just the word terrorist is very much on the lips of the public.
Yeah.
And you can see how, you know, that sort of
approach
is feeding into Star Trek as it should.
T'Kuvma, he keeps talking about prophecy.
Yes.
You know, so his motivations are that of spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
It is interesting to me to kind of witness in this current context as well. So I don't know if we've quite seen, you know, a super religious Klingon. I guess Klingons have a sense of spirituality, but
they do, but it's more like, you know, our culture is, you know, being warriors, and that's really all we got. You know, it never really dove into them being like this.
Barge of the Dead.
Well, that's true.
One of your least favorite Star Trek Voyager episodes.
Not one of my least favorite.
Well, I know you weren't fan of it. I liked it a lot more than you did.
Yeah, it was fine.
It was okay. It was fine. But I think the Barge of the Dead was probably the most that we got from Klingon spirituality.
Yeah.
I feel it's curious because, spoiler alert, T'Kuvma, did you expect T'Kuvma to die in episode 2 based on all the marketing that we witnessed?
I didn't know. You know, it's like, it's so hard to tell because they were hiding so much. And, you know, early into the Vulcan Hello, I said to you, boy, you can really tell they were just marketing episode 1 to everyone.
Yeah.
And so, I, you know, at a certain point, it's like, I don't know. Half this cast could be dead by the end of the episode. I don't know.
Well, Cam, is it worth noting, if you look at the title credits and you see all the actors listed in it, we are introduced to one Doug Jones and Sinequa Martin-Green. But beyond that, Star Trek, the USS Discovery does not make an appearance through the first two episodes. It's the namesake of the series. That is a very unique thing in Star Trek series premieres, is it not?
As far as I have seen, yes.
What do you make of this kind of setup? Is this Star Trek getting used to kind of the new era of television? And are you cool with that?
Well, I think that's going to be a larger discussion about this two-parter.
Okay.
But I will say, I wasn't thrilled to see Michelle Yeoh's name listed as special guest.
Mm.
That to me was like
a spoiler?
Yeah, that was a real red flag waving.
Yeah.
Like, okay, well, you know, I think I know what's going on with this character.
Right.
And I was correct. Spoiler.
Yeah, yeah. But do you think many fans out there thought that she was going to be there all the way until episode 15 of the season?
I don't think I don't know. It just depends on the degree of fan.
What about, okay, we were in Star Trek Las Vegas and they were selling pins of the Shenzhou.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, I don't know how much the Shenzhou is going to be featured in subsequent episodes of this series at this point. Would you be feeling a little ripped off if you were a fan that spent, what were they selling the pins for, like $15, I think?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'd feel ripped off for $15.
Well, I don't know. It's just like, for a lapel pin, I don't know. I'd be a little bit like, I thought this was going to be like the co-ship along with the Discovery, and then it's... I don't know what episode 3 holds, but we saw escape pods leaving the Shenzhou, right?
Yes, we did.
Did that confuse you at the end of Battle of the Binary Stars?
No, not really.
Okay, well, why were they being ejected, though?
They were abandoning the ship.
But why? Was the ship about to be destroyed, or?
I think it was kind of scrap metal at that point.
Okay. I thought, couldn't they have gotten towed or something?
Like, let it go, Tyler. Leave the Shenzhou alone. I know you've invested everything you all of your money in Shenzhou.
I'm a nitpicky man, Cam. like the USS Europa, it went and took a tractor beam and saved it from like being hit by a meteor. Why can't another ship come and, they had the USS Edison, the USS Earhart come. Why not grab the Shenzhou with it?
Those ships all left.
Okay. Okay. You got me.
I was going to say, though, is the Shenzhou the Captain Phasma of Star Trek Discovery, and that they market the hell out of it go before it starts. You know, Phasma, they had the world convinced that Captain Phasma was going to be a major character in Force Awakens.
I think that's an apt analogy there. Yeah. And you got the J.J. Abrams connection as well. So, Cam, overall, this reintroduction of the Klingons,
it worked for me. It worked for you. You know, I did not think going in that would be one of the things that would work the most for me. Yeah. And it did. Like, I genuinely thought, this is an angle I haven't seen before. This draws me in and makes me interested. And I want to see it developed more.
Yeah.
But it gave me enough that I thought, okay, they have an interesting take. I didn't think anyone would ever have an interesting take on Klingons ever again. Well, especially after Enterprise. I really like Enterprise.
Yeah.
But I can't say I was ever like, man, these Klingon stories, it's like they've got a whole new, you know, take on these characters.
What was the two-parter when they were dealing with the Klingon virus?
Oh, don't ask me
that. It wasn't Borderland, was it? Or was
that Borderland's the
Brent
Spiner? Yeah, that's the Augments arc. Yeah.
Okay, I apologize. Listeners, please send me hate mail. But I'm wondering, I think they're going to have to eventually touch upon that whole virus arc, right? With regards to the different look of the Klingons?
I don't know. Like, because I'm watching this two-parter going, oh, man, like, it's... I wonder how much they're investing in the new, you know, bringing in new viewers, and do they want to bog them down in that sort of stuff?
Right.
I don't know. It just depends. I don't know what their priorities are.
Okay, but T'Kuvma is talking about, like, kind of... almost racial purity, right? And I'm wondering if he's talking about maybe undue influence that the he mentioned humans, Vulcans, Tellarites, Andorians. I love those shout-outs there,
too,
Cam.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if he thinks that the Federation has the same designs as the Klingons. It's just kind of like dilute, you know, what they're all about. And maybe he's looking at that virus. Am I getting too geeky for like a premiere, a 1-2 episode premiere?
I would be surprised if they delve into the virus stuff. I think there's kind of going to be little nuggets there for fans to be able to be like, oh, they're talking about the virus and all that.
Yeah.
To me, I looked at that when that exact, you know, line of dialogue, I was like, that's very interesting because, you know, in the world of Star Trek, the Federation is America, right?
Yeah.
You know, he's talking about basically the melting pot and how it takes away, you know, the individuality of the race, right? You know,
right.
And so I'm like, that's definitely interesting to have this character who's basically waging a holy war against, you know, basically a melting pot of alien cultures.
Yeah.
I mean, again, you know, this series is taking what could be a very polarizing, like, season 3 Enterprise take on Star Trek. People may not like this. You know, it's heavy and kind of dark in a way that... It's very of the moment in a way that will be interesting to see years down the road if people say they went a little too heavy on that or it was a little too hard. We don't know where, you know, this is only 2 in the episode, in 15 episodes, but I am curious if this is going to be timeless or it's going to be timely.
Well, Cam, I think I'm fascinated by what fan reaction is going to be. Something you and I did not do at the top of the episode is just kind of give our overall feeling. We can dive into the details later on, but watching this episode, what did you come away feeling from it?
One of my big things was that this feels unlike any Star Trek series I've ever seen. And it's going to take serious readjustment of my own calibration, because I've watched every episode of previous Star Trek. And I've watched the show evolve from the original series, you know, where it's like 50-minute episodes. It's a little more of a hangout, slower paced in a lot of ways, you know, series. To Enterprise, which was a little more fast-paced, for sure. You know, they would have episodes where it's kind of shaky cam action and things like that. This does not feel like any of those. To me, this feels like almost breathless in a way that I was both prepared for, but also surprised by.
There's more of a narrative thread going throughout this.
Like, it's propulsive in a way that I feel like Star Trek, the difference between Star Trek and Star Wars is Star Wars is breathless and always racing forward, whereas Star Trek, you're taking time to think, you're taking time to ponder. You know,
it's contemplative.
It's the characters are engaging in dialogue with one another. And this, to me, felt more of like, you know, a lot of people had criticisms with the J.J. Abrams movies for being a little more Star Wars pace-wise. And that's how I kind of felt this was. Like, I talked, I think it was maybe the last episode we did, how I had questions about what 21st century Star Trek was. Mm-hmm. I'm beginning to think J.J. Abrams did set the template, because a lot of the visual palette for this series feels very J.J. inspired.
Oh, absolutely.
The lens flares and all that sort of thing. Maybe Star Trek is going to do fast-paced for at least for, you know, this iteration.
Okay. It's kind of like the Fast and the Furious thing, where the first movie starts with them stealing DVD VCR combo players.
Right.
And the last movie we just saw, Cam, they're trying to save the world from nuclear war.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like kind of upping the ante in a way that we haven't really experienced before, or where the franchise had never gone before.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what kind of sold me on this series. So I'm coming away very positive. I'm not watching this saying, oh, it's a disgrace to the Roddenberry legacy at all.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I think it's and I don't mean this as a positive or a negative. It felt weird. Like, where I was like, wow, this is not.
But isn't it good that it feels different? Like, it doesn't feel like a retreat on, like, what you've seen before?
But the pace of it almost held me at arm's length with the dramatic aspects of it.
Okay.
I'm hoping that as I kind of sink more into this world and get more used to its rhythms, that won't be the case.
But I think we're on the same kind of path, because I'll tell you the two moments in episode one and episode two that probably my favorite scenes, though. It's when we jump into the Shenzhou for the first time, and we have Burnham and Saru kind of going back and forth. And then finally, Captain Giorgio says, wait, my two senior officers actually agree on something? That's a first. It felt as if there's that hangout factor. You always bring up the hangout factor as being a very important thing about the Star Trek experience. I think a lot of fans agree with that.
And I think that's why the original series and Deep Space Nine are my favorites.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And it makes sense there. So I kind of buy this rapport that we have between those three senior officers there. I'm sold on that.
I would have liked more of it.
I absolutely agree with that. Yeah. We got a little bit with them in the ready room looking through the telescope, you know.
Yeah.
But that first scene on the bridge, I'm digging that, because it feels as if, you know, they're focusing on the characters, which I always love when Star Trek does that. The second scene, and this is episode two, Battle at the Binary Stars, when we have that flashback to 7 years earlier.
Yeah.
And we actually see Burnham arrive on the Shenzhou for the first time with Sarek. She's clearly a different character than the one that we were introduced to in episode one. She has much more of that Vulcan influence. We can see what the effect of hanging out with humans has done to her.
Mm-hmm.
She's much more willing to, you know, take down that Vulcan shell that Georgiou referenced. And I kind of like that. It wasn't that breathless pace. It was like taking your time with it a little bit.
Yeah.
I think that they're going for a balance here. Maybe I would prefer more of the slower moments, the more character-based moments, but I hope going forward that they kind of realize they can find that balance. What do you make of it, Cam?
Well, you know, you and I have gone through and watched, you know, most at this point and covered for the podcast most of the premiere episodes of the various series. We just haven't done Enterprise yet.
Mm-hmm.
But we talked a lot how these premieres often felt, too, like, long. Like, they dragged them out a little too much, right?
Sure.
This one felt like it was too short.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I wish there was a moment where somebody was complaining about the apples on his desk, like an encounter at Farpoint.
I just think of some of the great dialogue sequences, though. You know, the moments that really built up character in an interesting way. You know, encounter at Farpoint. You know, you have that scene of, you know, Riker with Data in the holodeck. We learn something about Data there. There's a sequence where Sonequa Martin-Green's character, Burnham, talks to Saru, played by Doug Jones. And he's kind of talking about his, you know, alien species that he's, you know, from.
They're a farmed race.
Yes. And I'm like,
which is a horrifying thought.
And I'm like, you know, I'm appreciating this information, but it's very expositional. Like, I would have liked more of, like, a, you know, a conversation to take place between these two characters, you know, that wasn't quite like, let me tell you about my race.
But do you think one of the key things here, though, is if you look at the main cast, just looking at the credits,
yeah,
only Doug Jones and Sonequa Martin-Green are the only ones featured in both those, the first two episodes.
And special guest star.
Special guest star, you know, Michelle Yeoh.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a, it's a bit of a strange setup.
Yes. Though.
And I get where they're going because it's very clear that the Shenzhou is more, if you look at season one as an overall story, we're clearly at the inciting incident here. We're not getting into like kind of the meat of it. This is more like the prologue. So I kind of get the issue here. To me, it doesn't matter that, you know, Ensign Connor wasn't a fully fleshed out character, although he had his moments.
Sure.
That robot woman with the robot helmet and the wire fingers.
I was like, that's interesting.
She was taking a sick bay. Maybe there's more hope for her.
There's no more, I think.
No?
Okay. Yeah, I don't think so.
She was cool. You know?
She was. I was like, oh, that's cool.
Did she get a name?
No.
Okay.
I mean, maybe. I don't know. Like, a lot of these characters didn't have names thrown out because I was actually paying attention to hear the names because I didn't know the names going in.
Right.
And I was like, nope, not hearing names in any of these characters.
Oh, okay. Yeah, the redheaded woman who I believe was at Helm. I think Connor was at Ops, and then the redheaded woman was at Helm.
Correct, yeah.
I don't recall any name given to her.
Nope.
Okay.
I was looking to write them down as I was watching.
Yeah, okay.
The Klingons were being given names, but the actual crew of the Shenzhou were not for the most
part. Yeah, is it weird that I remember Orek, the guy who did not want to take up his brother, the torchbearer's position?
Yeah, you know, we had Cole introduced and Dekuvma. It's like, I remember these Klingon names. I couldn't tell you the names of the crew of the Shenzhou, which I spent 2 hours with.
Well, Cam, if I can reference another episode that we've done in the past, why do Starfleet admirals suck?
Yeah.
What do you make of one Admiral Brett Anderson? Is he going to be added to our list? Or?
Oh, he sucked.
Okay, okay.
It's funny because, a little behind the scenes here, Tyler had tweeted this actor when we released the Admiral Suck episode, and he tweeted this actor when he was cast and said, you know, hopefully you won't be making this list or whatever.
Yeah.
And the actor was like, definitely not. I think that's up for debate.
He kind of fell in the whole the same trope that every single admiral does, is where like he doesn't really listen to good advice, and he's not proven right at the end.
Well, the admirals are there to create an obstacle for your protagonist.
Yeah,
and that's not the best approach.
I'll try to redeem him in some way. So he's
died.
Well, he's on the Europa, right? And they self-destruct. They're getting like ripped apart by that giant Klingon vessel. And he's like, you know what? I'm just going to blow this baby up here. So he realizes, you know, his number's up. I'm going to go out with a blaze of, you know, glory, essentially.
Right.
So I'll give him that.
And he cranked up Bon Jovi.
I'm going to go put on my like nerd hat, but I had never noticed until now, maybe it had not been published, but the look of the admiral insignia, what did you make of that? Because it was distinct from what we saw with the rest of the characters here.
I gotta be honest, didn't really pay attention to it.
Oh, okay. No. Essentially, it was like around the Delta, but it was like kind of more kind of that look of the next gen sort of Delta, where like, you know how there's a circle or like a below the Delta?
Right.
And he had that, but it looked kind of like the Federation circle.
We didn't see those in Las Vegas, did we?
We did not, no.
Yeah, because they had a bunch of the uniforms, if anyone who wasn't in Las Vegas. Yeah, they had a whole Discovery exhibit where they had a bunch of the uniforms and all the various badges, but they didn't have that one.
And I also bought myself a badge when we were in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
And they had the command, the science, the operations, and the medical. And I walked away with the command one, which, Cam, I've got it right here. I'm going to hold it up. Are you regretting you didn't buy one of these?
No.
I'm
not a big, you know, button guy, so it doesn't really.
Okay.
It doesn't interest me that much. But you also.
How do you keep your pants up?
Rope.
like Jimbo from The Simpsons. Okay. Oh my Cam. Okay. We're going to bring something up. I don't want to cut you off because I think the thread that I'm going into is actually the most significant thing that we need to talk about here.
Well, let's talk about the visual look of this series because the money is all over the screen, and, you know, as I said, it feels very influenced, I mean, more than influenced, informed by the J.J. Abrams aesthetic.
Yeah.
How did you feel, you know, after watching, you know, I guess the Vulcan Hello we'll start with, but the visuals of the show?
This is the most distinct jump in the visuals that we've seen. Well, okay, I mean, it's easy to go from Enterprise to J.J. Abrams, but I would say that look that we have from, like, the Berman era, versus the Gene Kuhn era when he was kind of the guy producing everything. That was a big leap, right?
I mean, I would say there's a big leap going from the original series to the motion picture. Very big. You know, it feels very different. Yeah. But yeah, no.
And from maybe, say, kind of the film era to Next Gen, that's another visual leap. And then from that Berman era to Abrams, that's a bit of a leap.
There's a bit of a leap into Enterprise, too. A little bit.
A little bit, yeah. But it still feels like Berman.
It feels like an evolution from Voyager, which had that sort of gunmetal gray look. But Enterprise, it goes to year 2000s. Right?
I totally agree with that. Yeah. But from the Abrams to the, are we calling this the Kurtzman-verse or the Goldsman-verse? I don't know. But from... Abrams verse, Kelvin verse to Discovery, this doesn't seem like a giant leap, but it's very distinct from anything we've ever seen on television before. Overall, I dig it. Like, it has a very updated feel. It still feels as if I'm in... Okay, it feels like I'm in the Star Trek universe, but Cam, one thing that I noticed, like, very early on, though, is, like, I wasn't getting obsessed with how different this looked from all the other series. Like, this, it didn't bother me that the Klingons did not look like the Klingons from that era that we're familiar with. It didn't bother me that we have all these holographic displays when I've just been watching season one of TOS, and they're pretty much mashing their fingers against cardboard boxes.
Right.
It didn't bother me at all, though. What was your feeling about this?
No, in terms of the representation of technology or the depiction of technology in the episode, I just could go with it. I was like, oh, they're going to do holograms, kind of like the Darth Sidious from Enterprise.
Was that maybe a step too far? Because that was the one thing that I'm wondering if a lot of fans are going to be like, they were only experimenting with it on DS9.
Yeah, it does raise the question, like, why did they roll back to view screens for, like, the 24th century?
Yeah. Look, maybe that's going to be a season 7 episode where they explain why holograms don't work anymore.
Yeah,
but it was just, I don't know. But they did it on Deep Space Nine because they realized it's better for the actors.
Right.
Although I have to believe if they're doing like this holographic sort of look, the actors are not filming the scenes together. They might be off camera or something.
In front of a green screen.
Like reading lines to the other actor. But yeah, it's going to be green screen stuff. Cam, what did you make of Sarek leaning up against Burnham's desk like he's Tony Danza from Who's the Boss?
To me, it was more like he went all glitchy and he like went super speed for a second. I was like, wow, what the hell was that?
Is he able to see Burnham's like room? And is that why he's able to lean against the desk? How come Burnham can't see Sarek's room?
That's an excellent question.
I was very confused.
Yeah,
this is what my nerd brain goes to. It's just like, wait a minute.
You know, whenever you introduce new technology to an established universe, suddenly the questions are raised as to how this works, because there is not a lot of foundation for what we're seeing here.
Yeah.
I want to say about the aesthetics,
though.
You know, it has a very, like, there's a real CG sheen to this show. Like, it looks like every inch of this thing was run through filters.
Yeah.
In a way that I'm not a fan of in that aesthetic, whether it's... I tend to find film can pull off a little more because there's usually more money put into it and time. TV, it still holds me a little bit at arm's length. I have a hard time immersing myself in the world in the way that I do every other Star Trek series, where I feel like I'm on real sets. I feel like I'm on the Enterprise. You know what I mean? Like this, I'm looking at a lot of it going like, either that wall is CG or it's been given a CG sheen, in After Effects.
Sure.
And to me, it's going to take me a little bit to kind of get used to the aesthetic of this show.
You feel like you're watching Sky Captain in the World of Tomorrow?
A little bit, I'm waiting for like dead actors to reappear from the grave.
Okay.
But it's like
I
don't want to hold it against the show in the sense and say like, this show's ugly and I don't want to watch it. I mean, it's just like it's a look that's going to take me some time to get used to the sort of the energy of.
Okay.
Because I don't feel at home in it the way I do, going off at Counter at Farpoint, the first episode of TNG. When I walk into that bridge, down those corridors, I can feel kind of that living space, whereas I don't get a real feel for kind of the world of the Shenzhou.
But it's a problem because that ship is it even going to be part of the series going forward?
No, but
it just left adrift?
No, but I spent 2 hours with it, right?
I know.
Two hours of it, Counter at Farpoint, 2 hours of this. So
I still keep going back to the fact that the show's called Star Trek Discovery, and we've yet to see the title ship.
Tyler, isn't Discovery about her inner journey?
Oh, I guess.
It's a metaphor.
There's Discovery within us all.
Yeah.
I'll say this. The kind of hero shot of the Europa when it came to save the Shenzhou meteor. I actually thought that looked very CGI.
Oh, yeah. All of it. Yeah, the ships all look CGI.
No, but that one looked particularly cartoony. Like, it wasn't rendered. It wasn't like the A-team that had been rendering that particular one. There's right. subsequent shots that looked much better of the Europa, but that first money shot there, and with the tractor beams as well, I wasn't totally digging it. And the tractor beams pulling the Klingon corpses into the ship, to me, it looked a little too cartoony as well.
I liked it, though.
Okay.
Because it was showing me something I hadn't really seen before. You know, I've never seen Klingons beaming dead people back onto their ship. You know what I mean?
They weren't even beaming them. They were sucking them in.
They were sucking them back in. Yeah, it was like, tractor beaming them in. It was like a visual that I had never seen, and I appreciated that. Did it look a little bit screensaver-ish? Yeah, but, you know, it's like, I guess we're at a point now where we've seen so many variations on CG, whether it's good or not so great, that I can at least admire the what they're going for, because CG's so hit and miss.
I'm putting you on the spot.
Yeah.
Best special effect, worst special effect, or visual effect, I should say.
Oh my god. Oh,
I told you I'm putting you on the spot, sir.
I'm trying to think of the best.
Maybe easier to think of the worst.
You know what actually one of my favorites is actually right at the start of episode one, the Vulcan Hello. We're on that planet and we're seeing, you know, these alien eggs and whatever up in the cliffs and whatever. And, you know, they want to raise a well. They'll get the water back to save this alien species because of a drought. And there's a shot of the alien that was CG, but it has a real, like, almost like District 9 kind of, like, otherworldly look, as it's kind of looking at, it has, like, rags over it, so it's very subtle. But I like the weirdness of it. Like, you could tell it's CG, but because they kept it more to the imagination, it's just like you get little like subtle glimpses of this thing looking up and then running back to the water. I really liked that. If it was subtle.
Cam.
Yes.
That was my pick too.
Was it really?
Yeah, it felt like lived in. It felt real. It felt as if like, oh, this is a universe that is, you know, in the here and now.
Yeah.
And so I appreciated it. And I hope we're seeing more stuff like that in the future. Some of the space sequences, like to me, I'm not always that invested in a lot of the space battles. To me, they get a little bit samey.
Yeah.
So this is not something we've really seen in Star Trek before.
Right.
Like a CG rendered alien that doesn't look like 8472, which to me, I mean, some episodes it looked like we were watching Who Framed Roger Rabbit whenever the 8472 guys would appear.
Yeah.
This alien, were they called Russicans or...
I don't know. Ruskians? I missed that. I'll have to catch that on the rewatch.
Yeah,
but
please forgive us because we literally just watched the episode, but mere moments ago. So forgive us if we make mistakes. So,
but it had so often on Star Trek, the aliens, just because of the, you know, the budget they were working with, they were all just, you know, humans. So you couldn't get this sort of level of alien weirdness to them. And I liked that these aliens, they seemed like something, like if you're going to a planet far, far, far away, you might see something like this where it's like, I don't know what that is. And they're behaving in a way we can't quite understand. And I really like the
aliens from Operation Annihilate, right? floating amoeba.
Yeah, I like those. And you asked the worst. The worst for me, it popped into my head as soon as kind of midway through talking about those aliens.
Can I just say my worst, but just in case we have the same one?
Yes.
It's when Burnham went through the shield in the brig, and then they opened the door momentarily, and they had like the CG field in front of the door, and I was just like, that looks really cheap.
That's not the one I
had. Okay, go for it.
Mine is actually, it's sort of a, you know, hallucination sequence, but it's the scene of her and Sarek talking in like space.
Mm.
And to me, it was like...
As I wrote in my notes, Sarek's calling long distance. With his Katra?
Yeah, that moment I was like, oh, this is two actors in front of a green screen. And I know it's supposed to look a lot more impressive and maybe a little more surreal than it does.
It was more like the C team from the VFX department was on that.
I think there's a little, that one was kind of rushed through a bit.
Kim, maybe, why don't we jump into this? Because I think if our topic is kind of ranking the first officers, we have an incident here that I think it's going to cause a lot of controversy among fans here.
Yeah.
Where we essentially have Burnham do a Vulcan nerve pinch on the captain, and then, as Saru puts it, like, this is mutiny, and goes forward with her plan to start firing on the Klingon vessel in order to engage in what she calls the Vulcan hello. What did you make of this? Do you think this is going to rub a lot of fans the wrong way when it comes to a first impression on Michael Burnham?
I don't know.
Would any other first officer from any other Star Trek series that we've seen before, would they have pulled this on their commanding officer? My answer is no.
Maybe Spock and like the Enemy Within. If it's crazy Kirk running around.
I hate that episode so much. Because I even thought about it. I was like, even Kira would not pull this on Ben.
No.
So this to me, I'm like, I wonder if a lot of fans are going to cling to this moment. It's like, oh, these people, they don't know Star Trek. They don't get Star Trek. This is not something any Starfleet officer that we've known so far would ever do to the commanding officer.
Yeah, and I mean, there's little glimmers that this character, may have like PTSD or something.
Yes.
From, you know, obviously as a child being, you know.
And then having to repress her emotions being raised in this Vulcan sort of society.
And so to see her lash out and like do the Vulcan grip on Philippa, it shocked me, which I loved. Like, this was not a moment I saw coming, and there's nothing I want less than a 2-hour, you know, first two episodes where I'm just like, yeah, that was pretty much what I expected. And so, like, when that happened, she's trying to take over the ship. I'm like, this I haven't seen. Like, I haven't seen, like, a Riker go rogue or something, you know? We've seen a lot of episodes where, like, maybe an admiral tries to take over the ship and they're crazy.
Yeah.
But we've never seen one where it's, like, one of the lead characters.
The closest we got is when we watched Riker in The Game and he starts bringing headsets to people. Yeah. He's like, yeah, you got to try this, guys.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there was the episode where Data went haywire.
And went to take Brothers.
Brothers and went to take over the Enterprise. That was a really good episode, or that part at least was really cool.
Okay. What other good episodes are there where we have the other crew members kind of go rogue?
I mean, there's a lot of Kirk stuff where it's usually like he's corrupted in some way.
Right.
Does City on the Edge of Forever count when McCoy gets all high on drugs?
Assassins! Yeah. Murderers! Assassins!
We've seen Spock lose it a couple times.
Yeah. This Side of Paradise.
Yeah.
So, okay. Yeah. Oh, even to a certain degree in Operation Annihilate.
Yeah.
Keep coming back to that one.
Yeah.
So, do you think that this moment, though, is going to be enough to turn a lot of Star Trek fans away from the series? Or maybe a lot of them that were going into it not really wanting to like it? Maybe this will be the moment that kind of justifies their dislike for the series.
This does go very much against the Berman era, with maybe the exception of DS9, which kind of operated in the shadows.
Sure.
But this is definitely going back to the fact that, like, you know, human beings are often fallible and can, you know, they're striving for something better, but they still have conflict.
Yeah.
And I really like this. This was like, oh man, I did not expect this to happen. And I like that this character is like behaving aggressively in a situation, and that's her go-to.
Do you think she like is ultimately proven right? She's justified in her attempt here?
It would seem so.
It would seem so.
But what I like too, that was that Philippa does not, the captain does not take it sitting down. She comes flying out those doors with a phaser at her.
Yeah, you know? Like that.
Like, this was not, your daddy's Star Trek.
Is this the fastest recovery we've ever seen from a Vulcan nerve pinch? And is it because since she's not a, Burnham is not a Vulcan, she may not quite have the strength to apply it the way that Spock would?
Well, I mean, I'd say the fastest recovery was when Spock did it to Khan in Star Trek Into Darkness, and he didn't even black out from it.
Yeah, okay.
So, yeah. But he was, you know, an augment, so I don't know.
Okay.
A little bit of a complication there.
So the other thing that I went into this just really wondering about is there going to be a sense of wonder, a sense of exploration?
Yeah.
I like the first act in which there's like this weird interference from that beacon, that Klingon beacon, and their response is to investigate.
Yes.
And Burnham's all for it. She's going to get into her EV suit, thrusters away, and fly towards it. So what do you make about the sense of wonder and exploration going forward in this series? I don't think we got much of that in episode two, but...
We got none in episode two, really, other than just kind of learning more about the Klingons.
Right.
In fact, I began to get concerned. I was like, oh man, please don't let the whole series just kind of be this serialized, where I'm like, going to be basically stuck in this one story.
Well, none of the Klingons are in the main credits.
Yeah.
So you got that.
Yeah.
We'll see.
This might be my favorite moment of the entire two episodes. is actually the sequence where she's flying in that EV suit. And look, I'm not talking about the flying in the EV suit because I've seen that sort of thing, obviously, in the J.J. Abrams movie.
Into Darkness, yes.
Two in a row, you know, obviously in 2009 as well. It was the moment where she starts laughing while she's doing it.
Yeah.
Because it felt like a human emotion,
yes.
Which the Berman era often would go against. And I love that this character was having a blast exploring, like getting to go through this experience. That, to me, is what I think makes me love the original series so much. It's like these people realize how awesome their job can be. You know, Riker has a bit of that too on Next Generation.
Yeah, but they're not quite superhuman as they are in like the 24th century, for example.
And I like that she bursts out laughing and then kind of contains herself to the mission. Like, that to me is like, this is a character that I'm interested in following.
Right.
You know, she's not like stoic and like kind of action, you know, figure-esque.
I just think the key to this particular thread is that if it's too serialized, all it's going to be about is this Klingon war.
Yeah.
I want them off on different planets. Maybe there's going to be a reason related to the Klingon War that they're discovering new civilizations. Maybe there's something they have to go fetch, and it brings them to a new planet. And you obviously can figure out that I don't want them just shooting ships at the end of every episode, right?
Right. And I mean, I think there's been some spoilers out there we won't reveal that there are going to be other things happening that it doesn't look like it's going to be solely Klingon War stuff.
Yeah.
But I do worry a little bit that, like, you know, we get that glimmer of that alien world at the start of part one, the Vulcan Hello. My worry is they're going to use those sorts of moments as punctuation for the series. Like, you know, kind of like the way that Into Darkness used the aliens that were like
volcano.
Yes, the volcano aliens, where it's like that's sort of your setup for the, but it's just kind of a brief like, oh yeah, there's another alien world. Let's get back to the story.
Right.
Hopefully it doesn't fall into that trap. We can't say, it's all guessing at this point because we got 13 episodes to go.
And Into Darkness, what planets? Okay, we went to the volcano planet.
Yeah.
We went to Kronos.
Yeah.
We went to Earth. Did we go to any other planets in Into Darkness?
I don't believe so.
I can't. Yeah, I don't know. I know it's an easy thing for a fan to like crap on Into Darkness, but I know that kind of bothers me.
Yeah, no, okay. I agree.
Well, Cam, I'm also curious. You know,
there's one thing I want to mention.
Yeah.
Can we talk about that opening? How did you feel about the Star Trek Delta in the sand?
I wonder if I would have felt differently had it not been spoiled for me through all the marketing that they did.
Right.
When I saw it, my first reaction during the marketing was like, oh, that's cheesy.
Yeah.
What was your reaction in this episode?
I thought it was still kind of cheesy.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, that seems like a lot of work.
Yeah, it does.
And I kind of was like, that feels like it's from something not as intellectual as Star Trek.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, I feel like a movie or something,
Lex?
A little bit dumber would pull that off.
If it was Lex, they would have spelled L-E-X-X. Yeah, I get it.
Yeah.
Okay. There's some nerd stuff that I want to get into.
Yeah.
No sightings of the Klingons in 100 years. So that puts it around the Archer era.
Yeah.
After that Klingon virus, though. I'm going back to the Klingon virus. Like, that was the last time that we saw the Klingons, right?
Was I alone in getting the real Balance of Terror vibe off of that? Because we know that they said that this series, or at least season one, was heavily inspired by the original series episode Balance of Terror.
Sure.
And once again, they're saying we haven't, you know, seen the Klingons in 100 years, just as in that episode, like, we've never seen a Romulan.
Yeah.
I buy that. Yeah. Yeah, it definitely had that vibe, sort of carry through. And the idea of like not really understanding this, you know, this threat.
Well, what does it mean, though, that like it's been a century since they've seen them? There's just been no diplomatic relations.
Right.
When they say we haven't seen them, does that include ships? Because even that seemed a little like unclear to me.
It is. And, you know, I wonder if Enterprise had gone 7 seasons, if there would have been more kind of tying off the Klingons for that era?
I have to believe that there would have been more Klingon appearances in the Enterprise era.
But it's not like Enterprise would have ever set up Discovery, right?
No.
It's like, you know, you just have to wonder.
I think it might tie back to the virus thread from Enterprise that explains the different looks of the Klingons from different eras. And maybe the Klingons are ashamed of how many of the people look at this point. Obviously, all the Klingons we see here, they look like the reimagined versions, but maybe there are different, more human-looking Klingons in the Empire at this point, and it relates to the virus.
Yeah.
Maybe Cole was not affected by the virus, but maybe his brother Kor was affected by the virus, and that's right. Why we see Cole and not Kor here. I don't know.
Yeah, I have no clue.
Okay.
I'm fascinated to see how much they're willing to dive into that, considering they want to target this show to getting new viewers into Star Trek.
I also wonder, if you think about the appearance of the cloaking device, did that throw you in episode one before they really explained it?
Not really.
Really? Okay, I was going like, continuity violation. Because we had not really had any evidence of any cloaking devices beyond what the Romulans had in TOS.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, this Klingon ship appears. And then they explain in episode two and says, oh, no, T'Kuvma devised a way of, you know, doing the stealth technology.
There's something very iconic, though, about the Klingon ship uncloaking. I think it's more iconic, frankly, than the Romulan ship uncloaking, despite the fact that the Romulans did it first.
I would say specifically the Bird of Prey, right?
Yes, yeah. Yes. And so it doesn't surprise me they're going to go there with the Klingons.
What did you make of the Klingon ship design?
Yeah, I was going to talk about that. I thought the ships were actually really ugly looking.
I thought they were very boring.
Yes.
Like, not distinct?
No, they were over-designed.
Right. Well, okay, so the flagship... Okay, so there are a couple different ships. There's the flagship.
Yes.
Or people are calling it the sarcophagus ship, I guess,
okay,
as well. There's also the torchbearer beacon thing.
Mm-hmm. I would have liked a better look at that. I never felt like I really had...
Burnham described it in quite a bit of detail.
Sure.
It's stone with metallic accoutrement.
Showing, not telling.
Yeah, I know.
You know, you should always be showing it. It's a visual medium. I would have liked to really understand what this thing looks like, because if you're going to create something like that, it should be somewhat like iconic. It should stick with you. You know, the way, you know, you look at, like, say, the Death Star in Star Wars. Like, you see it once, you're like, I know what that is. You know what I mean? Whereas, like, this... I couldn't sketch it for you on paper right now.
No, I could not do that either. But what, okay, you say that with the most prominent ship.
Yeah.
What about all the other peripheral ships that appeared? I could not, like, they just look like blobs to me.
They kind of look like reverse boomerangs to me.
Okay.
But with like bat wings on them.
Sure.
That was,
that was some of them. Those are probably the most distinct ones, but there's a lot of very, like, just amorphous looking Klingon ships. It's annoying because the TOS era ships are so, you know, like, visually dynamic and identifiable, and these just whatever.
Look at the approach to space combat of that show too. It's slower. We're seeing these ships set up in establishing shots and kind of circling one another. This is like chaos. This is like, you know, I don't know, like 80 ships all zipping around each other. It's like, I don't know.
Yeah.
And I mean, ultimately, a lot of them are not that important.
Probably because, not.
You know, what really matters...
No, Cam. There are 24 ships representing the 24 houses of the Klingon Empire.
Yeah.
Was it funny to you or kind of annoying to you that Michael Burnham apparently figured out the entire Klingon plot just by counting the number of ships there?
I'll just go with it.
Okay. Rolled my eyes. It's just like... It bugs me where, you know, both sides of the narrative, despite not really communicating with each other, know exactly what the other side is doing. And it's like, Burnham's figured it all out, guys.
You know,
is that because she's a xenoanthropologist?
That's exactly why. She also had the Deus Ex Serica.
How so?
You know, I felt like Sarek was here to explain things and set things up that are going to be going on.
And
you know?
His Katra's part of her.
How did you feel about Sarek in this? I had issues.
Is Sarek necessary, or is it just fan service? Could it have been any other Vulcan? And at this point, I say yes. It could have been any other Vulcan, so why go with Sarek?
To me, yes. It did not feel like Sarek. It did not have, like... Mark Leonard definitely has that sort of... kind of a little bit uptight, sort of intellectual feel to him.
Yeah.
But he never comes across to me as, like, really, like, cold and kind of... I don't know, like harsh. Whereas like
really? Like yeah. Not even Journey to Babel?
There's something about Mark Leonard's face though that just has more character to it.
Oh, yeah?
Like he looks like a guy who kind of has a little bit of a twinkle. He's I don't know, like he has more personality. Like this Sarek to me felt more like the
more like a Ben Cross.
Yeah, it felt like more of the Vulcan imitators we would see in series going forward where they played them as just like kind of jerks. Okay. As opposed to the original series, Vulcans have a lot of personality. I didn't feel like Sarek had any personality, really. There was like, you know, kind of digs about her having an emotional response to him showing up and what have you. But I didn't feel, like, this never felt like Sarek to me.
No.
And it didn't really feel like a character because really all he was doing was giving her information that would, you know, feed into the central plot.
Yeah, I guess the most he had to do is transport it onto the pad.
Yeah.
Briefly.
Yeah.
And he just kind of disappeared after that, like in the flashback scene.
Which, he's there to service the plot by bringing her to, you know, the captain.
I'd assume that he's going to be involved going forward. If his ward is imprisoned for life,
yeah,
I'm sure he's going to pay a visit.
Yeah.
You know? Maybe get her help out with a transfer onto the Discovery, which we're assuming is going to be coming up by episode 3, right?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah.
I would think so.
Okay.
Is the problem that Mark Leonard is just too memorable in that role?
I think it's his voice, though. I think it comes down to Mark Leonard's voice, which is kind of almost that transatlantic sort of accent.
It's very like older Hollywood style of approach to line delivery, yeah.
My son, Spock. That is nothing like
that. That is the worst Sarek I think ever recorded.
That sounds more like Samuel Clemens than anything else.
Shay.
Shay, Spock? Yeah. How's your mother doing?
To me, he just doesn't even, I don't know, he doesn't look like a Sarek to me. And like James Frayne may pull this character off later. Like maybe, you know, it's so hard to judge off a pilot because so much of pilots is all set up and exposition. And it felt like he got the lion's share of that sort of those duties.
I think it would have been better had they just called him something else.
Yeah.
Like Sporek or something.
And you could still work Sarek into the show in a way, but maybe not in this particular role.
Maybe we'll be surprised by the end of season one and we'll
be like MVP of the series with Sarek.
Yeah. But we'll realize that there was a very important reason why this character was Sarek and not some random.
Right.
So, Cam, when it comes to world building, two episodes in, how do you think this stacks up versus some of the other series that we've seen?
Well, let's look at some of the other pilots we've watched. Yeah. We won't maybe talk as much about Enterprise because we haven't covered that one yet. But I don't know that this does I don't think this does as strong a job, say, as the Deep Space Nine pilot Emissary, which I feel like really creates that DS9 world.
Like kind of the mythology?
Yeah.
But would you have known that after 2 hours, though? Or is it when you get to look back on this series overall and be like, oh, I see where the series started and I see where it ended up?
I think it does a far better job establishing the characters and why they're there and their struggles.
I will say yes, but I think it goes back to the fact that only two characters that are in the main credits that we've seen in the first two episodes.
But the problem is a lot of those characters on Deep Space Nine are adding to the world building. The characters of Kira, Gul Dukat, these are all adding to the overall sense of what this world is.
Nog's in episode one.
Quark.
Yeah.
You know, all of these characters are establishing the various views of Deep Space Nine and how the world works of Deep Space Nine. We don't even know what the world of Discovery is. We didn't see it.
No, we've yet to visit Discovery.
Episode 3 could be in a prison colony for all we know.
Yeah, is she going to be hanging out with Tom Paris?
You think that's where she meets Captain Lorca?
Yeah. Well, she in New Zealand. Yeah. The penal colony there. Okay. To me, and also maybe when I think of world building, I'm thinking about maybe kind of the visual look of everything, the aliens that are established.
It establishes the Klingons.
Yeah.
And I don't know that it does a spectacular job at establishing where Starfleet is right now. Because to me, we talked a lot about how it feels very different than the Starfleet of the original series. And I didn't get a sense of why that is.
Well,
why does Starfleet
expand on that?
Well, you know, I look at sort of the way these admirals are, you know, popping in, the way the tech being so much higher, the way that Philippa is kind of captaining the ship feels very different than the ways we would see on the original series.
Well, back when women weren't allowed to captain ships, that was literally the plot of Turnabout Intruder.
Yeah, I know. I don't mean that aspect. It just feels like it's a completely different vibe. Like the world, like the Starfleet feels like it's conducted in a little bit of a looser way than anything we saw in the original series.
I'm not picking up on any of this because to me, it's such a it's so obviously a visual reboot of everything.
Yeah, it's true.
Has Star Trek ever been really portrayed super consistently, other than the fact that the admirals are usually like total bores?
You don't think there's consistency though across the Berman era?
Somewhat, but I mean, to me, I'm looking at Starfleet here, and I'm just not, I'm not feeling it as if like, oh, this is like totally incongruous with what we saw in the original series.
I guess to me, it feels kind of like the leap from the original series to like Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
Okay.
Where Nicholas Meyer comes in and redefines how Starfleet kind of works to a certain degree. That's how this kind of felt to me, where I was like, this feels very different. Yeah, it did.
I'm not picking up on any of that. To me, it just feels like we're explorers, you know? Their first assignment...
Did they explore?
Their first assignment that we see on the series is they're going to go open a well. Their second assignment is like, we're going to go repair a relay station. This seems like stuff that we would see on the original series.
But the energy of like the bridge feels so different to me. It doesn't feel...
Okay,
I know.
I feel like I'm just kind of like, you know, going back to the same thing. But when it comes to characters, only two characters in the main credits are
Is that a problem?
No, because I think we're thinking about it the way that we would watch 90s television, though. You know, like the episode one is, this is what the episode's going to be week to week. I keep going back to kind of David Simon, the creator of The Wire. He's done shows like The Wire, Tremé, Generation Kill. He just premiered his new show, The Deuce.
Yeah.
And it's all about world building. Like you start with episode one, and it's just there to build up where the show's going to. So I don't have any issues with how Starfleet's portrayed or how it's depicted or the fact that we...
I don't have a problem with it. It's more just it feels different to me, and it's going to take some time for me to get my bearings.
Okay. To me, it didn't feel that different to me. It just felt like they're doing their whole Starfleet thing, you know?
It just feels like it's on a faster pace and sort of it doesn't feel like they have sort of the camaraderie that I see in the other sort of crews.
Okay, but Cam, I'll keep going back to this. It's the only two characters in the main credits are introduced here.
But this crew has been together for a while. Right. I'm talking about the crew episode.
Let's go back to that flashback that 7 years ago.
Yeah.
It's only Burnham and Saru and Philippa. Because Ensign Connor, he's at Ops, and we have the ginger woman who's at the helm, I think she was like an ensign as well.
Right.
So I don't think it's like a crew that's been together for 7 years. I think it's three senior officers that have been. And I feel that the three senior officers that we were introduced to, and I think it's smart for them to start small, knowing that they're not going to be focused on the Shenzhou, you know, throughout like another seven season run. I think that's smart for them to just like not try to develop all these like no names that we're not going to be invested in anyway. This show's not called Star Trek Shenzhou. I guess what I'm saying is
I would have liked a little more of kind of that hangout vibe of sort of these professionals bouncing off to each other to a certain degree in a way that feels human as opposed to tech bot.
But we got, I would say that we absolutely got that in the Vulcan Hello. At the Binary Stars, I'm totally with you. That is much more of a battle-focused sort of episode, save for that flashback moment that I'd mentioned.
Yeah.
You know? So,
and I think that's why that flashback's there in particular, to kind of give some human interest to it.
So I think the big concern, though, and, well, not a concern, but I think the writers are probably going to be cognizant of this, is when you introduce the new crew of the Discovery, there's going to have to be time spent getting invested in these characters. And everything that I'm hearing just from interviews, whatever, and based on these first two episodes, I have no reason to believe that that's not going to be the case. Like, I love all the rapport that we got between Georgiou, Saru, and Burnham.
Yeah,
like,
me too.
That works for me. Those three work for me here.
Yeah, me too. But it just felt like there is more like nuggets as opposed to I want a little more. Just a little more.
I agree. Yeah.
You know, I wanted, because... Can we just say, like, you know, Philippa meets a grim end at the end of battle at the Binary Stars.
She tripped on her blade, Cam.
She shouldn't have put on that Torchbearer outfit.
Nope.
But that.
Yeah, wait a minute. She did have the body armor on. And then she still got stabbed in the chest.
Yeah.
That's pretty crappy body armor.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry.
That moment meant nothing to me because I never felt like she was a human character because so much of her dialogue with Burnham is exposition.
Yeah.
And putting the pieces in place.
Did it feel as if
It felt like a waste of Michelle Yeoh to a certain degree because she's such a great actress. And I know she has what it takes to make us care about this character. Yeah. It's just that the character didn't have the breathing space to kind of win us over to a certain degree.
And we didn't necessarily hear about her life beyond the captain's chair.
Yeah.
You know, we don't know if there's... Well, although, I mean, did Picard have much of a life beyond the captain's chair? If Picard died at the very end of Encounter at Farpoint, do you think he would have had a big emotional reaction?
Maybe after he kicked Wesley off the bridge. I would have been like, that's pretty...
Yeah. I like.
I kind of liked him.
Any captain that died at the end of an episode, I don't necessarily think that... after a two-hour series premiere, I don't think he necessarily would have had a big emotional, you know, gut punch, you know?
Yeah.
You know, which...
I guess it wouldn't, maybe you wouldn't care as much if they'd cast someone else, but like if you have Michelle Yeoh,
like a big name.
Yeah, it feels like use her for something worthwhile.
Sure.
And I mean, she does in the sense that it's a strong female actress on the screen opposite Sonequa Martin-Green, which is great to see. But it just felt like, oh man, if you're going to score Michelle Yeoh for a Star Trek series, you hope that this is going to be a character we're going to talk about. You know, we still talk about Captain Pike from the original series.
Yeah.
Jeffrey Hunter brought a lot to that character in one episode.
I thought it was Sean Kenny that brought the most.
He still brought a lot. We talk about Burnt Pike. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. Burnt Pike's in two episodes. I feel like I have more of an impression from Burnt Pike than I really do from Philippa because I don't get a sense of her personality.
Burnt Pike. I just
I like
wonder...
we're comparing her to Burnt Pike.
No, I'm just saying, like, I think Burnt Pike has become iconic. Is he a fully developed character? I would say no.
But, like, look at Jellicoe from Chain of Command.
Okay, yeah, you know, I buy that, yeah.
And, you know, we have talked so much about Jellicoe and how great a character he is.
Cam, is this the last that we see of Michelle Yeoh? I don't believe so.
There might be some flashbacks,
I think there are going to be flashbacks.
Yeah.
So, I'm not too concerned. I think we are going to get that character far more fleshed out going forward.
But
so,
it's
not a big concern for me.
If you're going to give a death scene, you want it to mean something. Or at least have an emotional, like, you know, Sonequa Martin-Green's character, Burnham, is very upset about this. I would have liked to have felt a little more of what she's feeling in that moment, as opposed to
bring
on Lorca.
she when she's, like, on the transporter pad, you know, like, wailing, I'm just kind of like, does this necessarily work?
You know, you compare that scene in the 2009 J.J. Abrams movie. You know, Spock's mom, you know, played by Winona Ryder, dies, Amanda. We'd spent, what, maybe like 5 minutes with Amanda?
Yeah.
There's far more emotion in that scene of Uhura talking to Spock and, you know, kind of comforting him than anything to do with the death of Philippa.
But I would say that has more to do with Spock than Amanda.
Maybe what we needed was a scene between Saru and... And Burnham after this happened.
Before we see her before that tribunal of admirals and she's sentenced to life imprisonment. There should have been a Saru scene.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, they've said Saru is like the kind of the Data Spock character of the series. He wasn't displaying sort of a real sense of depth up front.
Well, let me say this, though. I like the fact that they made him a very distinct character and that he's always worried.
Yes.
That's not something we see... at all.
He's
among
me in
main,
space.
Well, when it, yeah.
He's like, guys, let's just go home. Come on.
When it comes to main characters, this is not something we've really seen before.
Right.
I think Ezri was, she would get space sick.
What about Bones?
No, but Bones wasn't like, hey guys, let's go home.
He was like, get the hell out of here, Jim.
Well, you know, look, we even got to, did you notice that moment where like these kind of gills opened up on Saru and like these little antennae like shot out? Like I thought that was like a cool moment. What do you make of the is it Kelpian?
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you make of the Kelpian species? I think it's kind of a cool sounding thing in that it's so distinct from what we've seen in Star Trek before.
Well, I mean, I guess you could compare it to like T'Osk and the Hunter and what have you. We've seen sort of the idea of the hunted species before on Star Trek. But
he's essentially comparing his species to like Chattel, though.
Right.
So, we haven't really seen Chattel like depicted as like a sentient life form on Star Trek, which I think is cool.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So,
I will say, like, I really liked Saru in this episode. He's a character I can't wait to see developed more.
Yeah, yeah.
I really liked him on this 2 hours. I wanted to love him. I want him to be like a character right off the get go. I'm just like, man, this character is magnetic. You know what I mean?
But did you have that feeling about any characters after, you know, the 2 hour premiere of other Star Trek series?
That's an excellent question. I'm kind of doing the mental backtracking because a lot of them I didn't see the pilot first, like
right?
TNG. I didn't see Encounter at Farpoint first.
Same here.
I'm going to DS9. I think
honestly
bonded quite strongly to like the Kira character off the bat.
Okay, I think a lot of people probably responded that way to Tom Paris though, because if you look at Caretaker, it's very surprising to me when we rewatched it recently that Tom Paris is actually the main character of Caretaker. It's not Janeway. It is a Tom Paris episode, and I can understand why he's such a big draw for a lot of fans still to this day.
Okay,
I get why you're not, Saru's not your number one, like, new favorite character in the entire franchise at this point. I see a lot of potential for Saru.
Oh, he has boundless potential. I can't wait to see where this character goes.
Yeah.
I mean, like, this, man, you almost want to revisit this episode once we finish the season.
Yeah.
Because it's not like a Counter at Farpoint where it's kind of this standalone story that ends with, well, what other adventures are waiting for us out there, you know, number one.
Right.
It's like, it's such a chapter one of, you know, a novel where I don't know where we're going. It's all going to lead into the next episode. You want to know where this character is going just to be able to go back. You know, like, I really appreciated going back to the DS9 premiere Emissary and being like, man, like, so much of this was set up. Whereas, like, when I watched it the first time, I found it kind of a bit of a slog in the sense of, like, boy, they're sure, like, layering on all this, like, mythology of Deep Space Nine. When you go back, you're like, man, they were really setting it up well.
But would you call this two-episode premiere experience that we've just had a slog?
No, not at all. It's almost like the opposite problem.
Okay.
It moved so quickly. I was like, oh, okay. Maybe like I'm looking for a middle ground. I'm like that picky person that can't pick between the two. So I was like, I want the middle ground.
And I'll be honest with you. My prediction is in episode three, if we're going to get the introduction of the Discovery, I still think we're going to be at a faster pace. I don't think we're going to get those heavy character moments into maybe episode four or five at the earliest. So I would say, just to everybody out there, just be patient if we're looking to get more invested in the characters.
Definitely.
I think they're still in the world building mode at this point, and it has to do with we're in the new era of television. It's not that episodic 1990s Berman era of Star Trek anymore, which I'm fine. Like, Star Trek has to evolve like everybody, right?
Definitely, and they're also wanting to set up the world of this series for people that have never watched Star Trek.
Yeah, yeah. So,
and so I think, you know, I have to be patient to allow them that, you know, to allow them to do that.
Cam, going into this, were you a little bit concerned, or have any of your concerns been alleviated after watching this 2 hour premiere experience?
Well, we were going to talk about marketing a little bit, because I think you said the marketing felt atrocious to you.
I would say, like, the dialogue that they chose to market it, I thought it was all pretty atrocious dialogue in the way that they spliced it. But when put in context, I think it actually worked much better. A lot of, like, the Sarek stuff, like, a leader has to have a purpose. And then you realize in context, he's actually talking about T'Kuvma.
Right.
I thought, like, the whole time he's talking about, like, Burnham, which is what marketing is. And I think the subtext is maybe it's about Burnham. But here, when it's put in the context of the Klingon issue, I'm like, oh, okay, this actually is not cringeworthy dialogue at this point. Are some of your concerns about dialogue somewhat alleviated after watching this episode 1-2?
Yeah, I didn't find the dialogue, like, too cringeworthy. Yeah. There was a couple moments that were a little clunky with exposition stuff.
Yeah, that happens in every Star Trek episode.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But no, I was okay with that. I think what was interesting to me was, you know, and we referenced this, I think, on the last episode or something, where we said, like, the beyond marketing, where we were like, what is this show or this film? You know, the marketing seems to be obscuring something, and then they really didn't. I kind of felt the same way with what I'd seen for Discovery. Like, I didn't walk out of this being like, well, that had definite surprises.
There were a few surprises.
There was a few, but to me, it felt pretty straightforward with what I expected.
Yeah.
And I'm not disappointed in what I got.
Yeah, same here.
In fact, it was probably better than what I expected, because I thought, you know, the trailers just, I mean, they were even more sped up, infinitely more sped up, where I didn't really get a feel for anything.
Right.
And so I think it's more successful. But again, it kind of falls into the Beyond territory where I'm like, how do you market it? Because it was honest.
Yeah.
I can't say it was dishonest marketing.
Yeah. To me, overall, looking back at this, I'm far happier than I was maybe anticipating just a few short months ago.
Mm-hmm.
I'm excited about where the show goes. If this lasts 7 years, I'm happy to follow this universe for the next 7 years.
Yeah. Like,
are you?
I'm not going to like double down on that yet, but I'm going to say that...
But episodes 1-2 show enough potential,
yes,
correct?
Yes, I'm encouraged.
Yes.
I'm liking what I'm seeing, and I'm hoping to see it fleshed out to something that like stands up with the great Star Trek series.
Right.
I would love to see, you know, season 1 of Discovery be, you know, like up there with like even like season 3 or 4 of Enterprise.
Okay.
Where I'm like, yes, you know, it's, they've figured out what the show is. They know what they're doing. And for, you know, for a, you know, first pilot for Star Trek, it's pretty confident.
Yeah.
And a lot of the times the series haven't been, even, you know, the ones I've liked.
Okay. Maybe a little bit of housekeeping before we kind of start to wrap up, Cam.
Well, should we say, ranking the first officers.
Okay, ranking the first officers.
Where does Burnham rank for you right now?
Well, she's above Chakotay, because nobody can go below Chakotay.
I think she might be below Chakotay for me.
Well, with regards to her actions, like, like doing the Vulcan nerve pinch on a commanding officer. But as a fully fleshed out character, I'm far more invested in her journey than I ever was in Chakotay's.
Right.
So to me, I think my rankings, I probably go, oh man, I'm going to feel bad if I don't have it exactly how I remember it when we did ranking the first officers. But I know my top tier would have consisted of like Riker, Spock, and Kira.
Right.
And then probably like Chakotay at the very bottom and T'Pol in the middle.
Yeah.
I would put Burnham.
And who did you have new Spock? Was he at the bottom?
I think he was towards the bottom just because, I don't know, I like Zachary Quinto's performance, but he doesn't seem to really have Kirk's back all the time. So I would put Burnham as an interesting character, a character with potential. I would put her about like T'Pol level at this moment. I'd be surprised if like at this point in the game that Burnham doesn't get elevated quite a bit. She's going to be the main character. I see enough potential with the actress. I love the conflict within the character. Pulling a Vulcan nerve pinch on your commanding officer, that takes cojones.
That could be, you know, like an iconic moment.
Yeah.
When we look back on this series in the years to come, you know, that in episode 1, Burnham gave the Vulcan, you know, nerve pinch to the captain. Like, that's something no first officer has done.
Yeah. Cam, what do you think overall? Where would you place Burnham at this point?
If I'm talking in terms of, like, duty, would I want this character as my first officer?
Well,
she's ranking at the bottom of the list. But in terms of, like, potential as a character, I agree with you around the T'Pol level.
Okay. Cool.
You know, where I'm, like, kind of mid-tier. She's definitely already got more personality than Chakotay. but it's kind of like that T'Pol thing where I'm, like, where is this going to go?
Yeah.
You know, like, T'Pol had so much potential. And sometimes she went really high, and sometimes they treated that character like crap.
Yeah.
And so
I don't think Burnham's going to be treated like
crap. Well, she's
crap.
A huge advantage of that the show is built around her.
Yes.
So I suspect she'll climb the ladder.
And I think there's a little bit of inherent misogyny in the portrayal of women on Enterprise.
Yeah.
I don't think that's going to be the case here in Discovery.
Well, hopefully not.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, look, this character has a shot at being the number one, like, because she's going to be probably the most dynamic first officer we maybe have seen, because usually the captain is the more dynamic character on all these shows.
Yeah, and being main character, as you said, I think she has a bit of an advantage there.
Definitely.
Cam, just before we wrap up, thoughts about the title sequence? This is like no title sequence we've ever seen before in Star Trek. What do you make of it?
I think it's going to be polarizing for people.
Okay.
Kind of in the way that the Enterprise one was, except that had the song, which, you know, I know obviously drags into a whole other territory. My feeling on it was that I like the music. I genuinely like the opening score. I think it works. I don't think it's like, it's one that I wonder how I'll feel about after hearing it like 10 times.
Music?
If it kind of like really gets that kind of sweep for me. I'm not someone who's usually wowed the first time I hear an opening theme song. So, you know, but I like it.
No, believe me, when I first heard the theme song that you made for our podcast.
Right.
It took me about 100 listens. I was just like, okay.
You're still like, I don't know about this. Yeah. This is embarrassing. Yeah. Like, get out the Casio keyboard. But the opening credits themselves, I like that they went for something different.
Yeah.
I don't know how I feel about it.
I'll tell you how I feel.
It doesn't.
I love it.
You love it. Okay. Yeah. It doesn't to me grab me in that sort of the sweep that Star Trek does traditionally. Like I admire it more on like an aesthetic sense of like I appreciate what they were going for artistically, but I'm not like take me to space. You know what I mean?
I know. I buy that. Yeah. I buy that. To me, it's representative of Star Trek in the new era. This is, you know, I kept going like, hey, this kind of feels like Mad Men, but like a very epic sort of Mad Men opening credits. I agree with you. Like, I think it'll take a few more listens, but I'm already digging the theme. I don't think it's as up-tempo as maybe I figured it would be.
That's very much modern music, though, now in film and TV.
But this is, well, this almost kind of reminds me a little bit of maybe the DS9 kind of like slow build sort of credits. But I think this is, honestly, Cam, when we're in Star Trek Vegas next year, they're going to be playing this, they're going to be conducting this at a certain point, because they do live musical performances at these conventions, and I would expect to hear something along these lines next year, right?
Yeah, and it, you know,
and I'm looking forward to it.
It does feel like a little bit of a safe response to the Enterprise reactions, where people went like hated that so much that it felt like they're like, okay, look, guys, let's play it a little bit safer, and maybe they didn't go as daring as they could have. Like I think the Michael Giacchino score for the J.J. Abrams Star Trek movies is absolutely fantastic.
Yes.
I think it's genius what he did with those scores. I would put, you know, his main themes for those two films up against most of the other Star Trek themes. I think it's fantastic work. This doesn't feel like fantastic work. It feels like good work. They were like, it felt like they were really like, make me a Star Trek theme, as opposed to like, swing away for this one.
Sure. But I would still say it's early on.
Definitely.
So
it's a grower, hopefully.
Yeah. They may revamp the theme going in season two.
Yeah.
You know, maybe the opening credits. Although I get the sense.
The Captain Lorca remix.
It's like Skrillex sort of like.
Dubstep.
Dubstep. Yeah. or if it's Jason Isaacs, like, is he into dubstep? What kind of like remix would a Jason Isaacs kind of character be doing?
I picture him as a dubstep guy.
Okay. I dig.
I want Lorca to like walk on screen to
dubstep. I'm picturing him as like a Trent Reznor sort of fellow, you know, like in kind of the black latex, like just like wailing into his microphone, you know, his looking ripped with a sleeveless shirt. Boom, psh, boom, psh, boom, psh. look up the lyrics to Nine Inch Nails Closer, guys. That you can figure out Cam's joke there. Anyways, so Cam, why don't we talk a little bit about what we're going to be doing going forward with our Subspace Transmissions franchise that we've got going. But you can look forward to videos, you and I. If you haven't watched already, go to our Facebook page and check out the video that we've already posted this week. Even our hot take, it's going to be a little bit different than our in-depth podcast. You and I, we're also going to be doing blogs, so fairly quickly sometime this week. You'll be getting a blog from an individual blog from me, an individual blog from Cam as well. It's going to be unique, so it's not going to be like a recap like we just did here, or our own individual reviews. I think there's going to be so many of those all over the internet. You and I, we've kind of devised a way to tackle what's happened in this past week in a very different way, and we're going to be doing that for the next 7 weeks while this season 1.0 is on the air in the fall.
Right, definitely.
So that's going to be fun. Cam, is there any sort of viewer mail or listener mail that we want to share? I think the thing that we've been doing a lot is maybe reading emails or sharing voicemails, but why don't we kind of maybe jump into kind of the social media stuff that's been going on, because we have YouTube comments. We have Facebook comments, and I feel like we kind of neglect those a little bit.
Yeah, so we had a review come in from Christian Larson that I wanted to reference. Again, like, we always appreciate reviews, whether on the iTunes or on the Facebook page. The iTunes is a little bit complicated because we're in Canada, and so we don't see reviews that aren't sent from Canada. And so if you do leave a review for us on iTunes, maybe, like, send us a Facebook screen capture or something.
Sure.
So we can read it on the air.
Yeah.
Because I have no idea what our American iTunes page looks like.
Well, you and I, we're going to be in San Francisco for the Star Trek convention in October. So maybe when we connect to Wi-Fi, we can see what our American friends have been commenting on.
So, yeah, hopefully. So Christian Larson said, I just discovered this podcast, and as a diehard Trekkie, I am loving it. Best podcast about Star Trek out there, in my opinion. I can't wait to listen to all the older episodes. Keep it up. What's funny is, and I want to say thank you, Christian, for that kind comment.
Yeah, thank you.
Is that he followed up almost a short while later with a response to that saying, ugh, I feel like I need to deduct one star now that I listened to the Star Trek First Contact review. That made me laugh so hard.
Hey, I was totally for Star Trek First Contact.
Yeah.
My number one Star Trek film. Cam, you are the one who is being rather negative on that particular one.
I'm the Debbie Downer on First Contact. I'll own it. You know, who knows? Maybe one day I'll write like some sort of review for the blog or something. I don't know.
We'll see. We'll see.
We'll see. Who knows? But
isn't there also like a YouTube comment that we got fairly recently, Cam?
Okay, so we had a video up on YouTube that we did recently called Will Trekkers Like the Orville? And we'll get to the Ortonville in just a second with his review on episode 3. But we had a comment on that video from Luke who said, in response to Will Trekkers Like the Orville? He said, they do. I've checked. And I am a Trekkie and Orviller. Just made that up. But the Trekkies may get mad because it's spelled Trekkies, you little targs.
Okay. Should we reignite the whole debate about whether it's Trekkies or Trekkers, Cam? Is it even a debate? I think either one is perfectly fine. I prefer Trekker. I think you prefer Trekkie. Is that correct?
I am so indifferent.
Indifferent. Okay.
I usually don't, you know, I usually just say Trek fan. I don't tend to use one or the other.
Yeah. I don't
like to belong, Tyler. That's my problem. Okay. I'm too much of a loner.
I think Gene Roddenberry preferred Trekkie.
Yeah.
Whereas I think a lot of people had negative connotations with Trekkies.
And that has gone away.
Yeah. So I've always kind of gone with Trekker, but honestly, does it really matter? Both are perfectly acceptable.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, but I think Trekkie is more common.
I think Trekker may fade. I think Trekkie will be the one that lasts.
Yeah. But Trekker's still around after 50 years.
It is.
So
for sure.
It's just I when I posted that video, I wrote Trekker and I am not ashamed to do so. So
right.
Whatever. Speaking of the Orville, though, I'm on episode 3 of the Orville, Cam.
Yes.
I think you had such a negative reaction to episode 1. You said you're just not going to watch it going forward. I said, I'm curious enough. There's so many people behind the scenes involved with Star Trek. It's such a Star Trek homage. It's just a curiosity factor here. But episode 3, I think, was an utter train wreck disaster, in that they were trying to have this morality play about infant sex changes.
Right.
I kid you not. One of the main characters, Bordos, comes from an all-male species. He hatches an egg containing a female version of a species. So him and his mate, they debate having the female baby go through a sex change. The doctor won't perform it. They go back to their home planet, and there's a big tribunal going on. And you find out about, like, I don't know, like a lot of characters from this planet are actually born women who got sex changes or else became authors that hid in caves. Like famous authors that would pretend to be men but hide in caves and write books that were revered by the male population. It was such a bad train wreck of an episode in that there was no point of view. The show had no point of view. They said, well, in some cultures, if you had a cleft palate, you would get that cleft palate fixed. And here
they actually said this?
Yes.
Holy shit.
Yes. and they also, I think Seth MacFarlane, his Ed Mercer character said, like, what if you had a third leg? Wouldn't you get that third leg just removed? Nobody would bat an eye. And that's what they're doing in their culture. They're not batting an eye and getting the sex change. The problem is that this is not an applicable story to anything. Unless we encounter another alien species that has this very issue, there's no applicability towards this in our real life. Like, if they wanted to deal with something, and this is very severe, but like female genital mutilation, for example, you know, then you could come down with a point of view where I think it's, you could argue, oh, it's a cultural thing, but we could say it's a very bad cultural thing.
Definitely, yeah.
But with this, there's no point of view. They're like, well, on this side, and then on that side, how do you know? It's just a sex change for the gender.
Right.
And you're just like, what was this show even about? it was just so haphazard. And then when they get to the Clear Trek homage, where there's all these courtroom dramas going on in Star Trek, if you're talking about Measure of a Man or the Drumhead, some very good examples of this. This is just such a bad, heavy-handed courtroom episode as well, which essentially this species does not believe women are of equal stature. That's why you have to get the sex change. Cam, I'm still sticking around with the Orville. I'll watch episode 4.
Yeah.
We'll see, but man, oh man, this was, I don't know what McFarlane was trying to do. I don't even think he knew what he was trying to do with this one. It was pretty bad. So there you go. That's the weekly Ortonville report.
That's really heavy subject matter for that show to take on. I mean, I only watched the pilot, but nothing off that pilot would give me any confidence that that show is the show to tackle that sort of material. So, well, there you have it.
Yeah.
Okay, and I just wanted to actually chime in and thank all the subspacers out there that backed me in saying that Data was the second most major character after Picard on TNG.
Okay, yeah. Go check out our Facebook post all about this. In that, like, I made the point on the last week's episode that, one, William T. Riker is the most significant character after Picard, as we see throughout the series. He has more screen time devoted to him, more than any other character other than Picard. He has more episodes, like Riker-centric episodes devoted to him, than any other character besides Picard. But I think everybody's coming down on your side, Cam, in which Data's far more iconic.
Right.
He has far more standout episodes than Riker does, which I get. But that doesn't make him the most significant character. He's more iconic than Riker, but he's not more significant than Riker as portrayed throughout the series.
There was one listener who actually chimed in with a comment.
Okay.
Said, isn't Data's story really as representative of what the TNG is all about? I wouldn't say that about Riker.
Okay, but what do you think about the end of Data's story within those 7 years? I'm not talking about Nemesis.
Right.
Do we get any sort of resolution to this? Nothing.
Is there a final resolution? No. It's more about the growth of the character throughout the series and appreciating humanity and striving towards
it. What was Data's last standout episode?
That's an excellent question.
I think it's Descent Part 2. It's not Masks.
No, isn't there one midway through? The one where there's like a young girl that he befriends.
When he crash lands on that planet?
Yeah.
And they call him the Iceman?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that's his...
Is that an iconic Data episode?
Yes, it is.
Is it?
Yes.
And you can't remember the name of it?
No.
Nor can I.
It's a masterpiece.
Masks is more memorable than this one, though, right?
Yeah.
I think the last real big standout one might be Descent Part 2. Like, I know the episode you're talking about, the Iceman episode. I don't think it's as well known as Descent Part 2.
No,
That's kind of the big kind of closing point of the Data story, where he takes the emotion chip out of Lore and he sits on it. I don't know.
What's Riker's final last great episode? And on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Go to facebook.com/subspacepod to add to the conversation. We would love to hear from all of you. What were your thoughts on Star Trek Discovery? We're going to have a video up there, as Tyler said, with our hot takes. We want to hear what your hot takes are. We'll read them on the air. We're looking forward to knowing what is, you know, the vibe out there for this show, because it's a strange one.
You and I are positive, though.
We are positive.
Yeah.
But I can also see people being negative, and I would love to hear those negative reactions and, you know, why you feel negative.
You love negativity, don't you? You live for negativity.
I bathe in it.
Yeah. So, that's why you're friends with me.
Exactly. And, you know, and of course, we'll have links up there on the Facebook page to those blog posts Tyler referenced earlier. There's going to be a lot going on now that Discovery has launched, so don't miss it on Facebook. Okay. Oh, Tyler, this is kind of a stupid question, but what are we doing next week?
Well, we're going to be doing kind of a, not a review of Context is for Kings. That's episode 3 of Star Trek Discovery. But we're going to be jumping off of another podcast episode. So we're going to like get, you know, Context is for Kings intertwined with another podcast episode, similar to what we did this evening. But it's episode 3 of Star Trek Discovery. That's going to be our main topic.
Do you think Context for Kings will be anything like Conscience of the King? Your favorite episode?
No, I hope not.
Okay, so you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam V as in Vulcan, check you later, Smith.
He had so many options, and he went with Checulata?
Yes.
You could have been Vok, son of Nun. You could have been Vulcan Hello.
Vulcan Hello's too, that's generic. That's the episode title.
Oh, Vok, son of Nun is pretty good. Save it for episode 3, maybe.
There you go. Oh, well, now you've given it away, so I can't use it now.
And you can find me at Reportin. That's REPORTONN, as in nerve pinch for the ages, fellas.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.